everybody, and welcome to a new episode of the Ung Podden with me, Martin, and my trusted ally and friend, Tove.
Yeah, I'm here.
And today we have a special treat for you guys. Alma Laureate, Laurie Holtz-Anderson, is with us in the studio. Welcome.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm very excited to be here.
This is such a weird and unexpected honor, I must say.
Oh, gracious. No, it's the honor is all mine.
I remember how happy I was when you got awarded the Alma Prize, because I recently just read Speak when you received the award.
Yeah.
And I was like, yes, she's so good.
Yeah. I'm still not over it. It, you know, I still, like, whenever anybody brings up the topic, I feel just like I felt when I got that incredible phone call from Boel Weston, who's the chair of the Alma jury. And I just, you know, to me, it feels like being 8 years old when somebody gave you an amazing surprise. Mm-hmm. And it's just, it's really lovely to feel 8 years old sometimes.
Yes.
So I feel very happy.
Sounds perfect to have that.
Yeah, like, yeah.
To give you joy.
Precise.
Yes. Yeah.
Precise. Exactly.
And I know that you're not the only author who has kind of felt that thing, because I remember when Sarah Hartnett received the award, she actually said that award saved her authorship. She couldn't afford writing anymore, and all of a sudden she had all the money and time she needed to write.
That makes a lot of sense. Makes a lot of sense. It's an incredible honor, and I think it's such a great example for the entire global world of children's literature. That children are important.
Yes,
there's an author and sometimes an illustrator, but that we are creating literature for children, and that's the most important thing that I know of.
Mm. Yeah,
I think so too.
It's a very important thing to make. Because you write for all ages, but also like for young adults, mm-hmm. it's usually maybe not the category of books that are like, I don't know, valued as they should be. I think
I can only speak to it from the American perspective, and in the USA we pretend to value children. But when it comes to the arts, I think any creator of children's books, illustrator or writers, the adult writers look down on us and it's like, you know, pat you on the head in a very patronizing way. And when are you going to write a real book?
Exactly. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. They have a lot to learn.
I think so. Yeah. For sure. For sure. Shall we dive into some of your books?
Yeah.
Maybe
to let's
discuss?
Do it.
Yeah.
Yes.
I most recently read Speak, is the one that I most recently read. And I had a question in Speak. It's about Melinda. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's your most famous book.
Yeah, yeah.
I should say, is it 25 years now?
Yes, it is 25 years. Yeah. It's so I feel like I'm at the midpoint now of my career.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it doesn't feel in the book as if, it is aged very well, I would say.
Yeah.
It is really... It's really current.
I did a sadly, right?
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be nice if we can move our cultures forward, where it becomes an old-fashioned book about the terrible things people used to do?
Exactly.
Yes.
I did a graphic novel adaptation a few years ago. It was illustrated by Emily Carroll, who is a Canadian artist. And the one thing that we changed was there was kind of an acknowledgement of technology. You saw some computers, I had to figure out how cell phones would fit into that narrative. Mm-hmm. But that's really all I changed.
Yeah. But it's cool to get the chance to maybe adjust some things.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I think
in truth, I cut out one scene. I think a lot of writers, our books never feel finished. It's annoying that they have to be published, because you're always like, oh, shucks, I don't need that paragraph. I could have cut that one too.
Yeah. So you got the chance to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, because I was thinking actually about the adults in Speak and in all your books. Yeah.
Right.
It's like you just want to hit them on the head, because why can't you see that this your child is hurting so bad?
I think it's important to remember that all of my books so far, all of my novels, have been written from a first-person point of view. Mm. And especially when you are writing in the first-person point of view of a child or a teenager, that's a brain that is still growing and developing. Mm. So we are seeing how the adults look like to the child, which is important. I know some universities use Speak and other my YA novels, not necessarily for the content of the book, but to get the new teachers to think about what they look like, you know, how their actions are being impacting the students and how to be a better communicator to young people.
Oh, that is so smart.
Yeah, right?
Oh, my God. It's like the best. Yeah. Yeah, because I was thinking, of course, this is Melinda's view of the adults. Mm. It's a terrifying, like, it's not what you want to be as an adult.
No.
To and young people.
Yeah, I wrote Speak, and then I wrote Shout a few years ago, and I think maybe I need to finish a trilogy, and the next one will be called Listen.
Right.
Yeah.
That will be so good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, I mean, all your kids, and those novels I read from you, they have, like, a sort of alienation from their parents, I guess you can say.
Well, yeah, I think that it is part of the human development.
Yes.
When you get to adolescence, puberty, and you begin, I think it's part of our biology to need to pull away from our family of origin, because you need to pull away in order to self-develop and determine your own path and begin walking that. And that can, if it's done in an unhealthy way, because the adults are struggling with issues or the child has some issues that's not being paid attention to, then it becomes alienation. Mm. In a healthy family environment, it's just slightly sad and annoying for people. Mm. And it's, you know, and you know, when you're that young, your brain, we know now that brains continue to develop at adolescent development until about age 25. Mm. So, you know, when you're talking to a 14-year-old, you're talking to somebody who's got another 10 years of neurological development and growth. And I think if adults understood that better, they could find more patience and more productive ways of those having those relationships. Mm.
Mm-hmm. But I thought about one parent in Winter Girls.
Yeah.
Leah's mother,
yeah,
who is like a medical doctor, and she's so hands-on,
yeah,
dealing with the mental disorder and mental illness and eating disorder,
yeah.
And I just wonder how did you think about that character when you wrote her?
Yeah, you know, it's first of all, Winter Girls is a book I wrote about eating disorders.
Yes.
And I had some friends of mine who are doctors who approached me and said, we need a book about eating disorders that will help open the conversation the way that Speak has opened conversations about sexual violence. And it's interesting, you know, I was very hesitant to write the book. Mm-hmm. And the fact that kind of pushed me to it was that anorexia has the highest fatality rate, that most people die of anorexia of any mental illness. I was like, oh my gosh. And when you think of a medical doctor, which is Leah's biological mother, is she knows these facts.
Yeah.
She understands more than anybody in the book how serious this disorder is, and that her child is running the risk of death on a daily basis. Mm. And she's a mother before she's a doctor. Mm-hmm. And she can't stop. You know, the mother has her own compulsions.
Yeah.
Right? You can see, and the compulsions that Leah has come, I think, biologically very, you know, easily you can see the mom's patterns of behavior. And this is why you need support. This is why, and the families who struggle with loved ones who have eating disorders, my heart goes out to them. Mm. It is probably, I think, worse than any kind of drug addiction. The society will tell you, don't do cocaine, don't do meth or any of those things. But society, at least Western society in the United States, you know, pats you on the back when you get skinny. Mm. You're celebrated for that. Mm. And while you can learn how to not take drugs anymore, you have to eat every day.
Yeah.
So, and then as if adolescent, and even in the most fantastically healthy families, adolescence brings challenges to everyone. Mm-hmm. And then when layered on top of those challenges, you have behaviors that can be fatally dangerous to your child. Oh, it doesn't get any harder than that.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree.
Super hard. I was just thinking, I actually have a kind of, I don't know, what you will think about this question, but what is like, I mean, you write books about really difficult issues. Mm. It seems maybe that's not all you do, but how is it to do that all, like a lot of the time, like these really heavy issues? Mm. How does it affect you? Or have you ever thought about like writing a happy love story?
I've tried and I suck at it. Okay. I think I'm still a dark, gloomy 14-year-old in my soul.
Yeah, right.
But my family went through some real challenges when I was a kid. My dad was an alcoholic. He was a veteran with untreated PTSD. My family comes from the north of New York. I'm in the north of Sweden right now, so I don't know if culturally they aligned, but my family comes from physical work, yeah, and poverty and silence. Mm. We're the frozen chosen, we call ourselves. Mm. And there was no, you know, my parents and my grandparents, they didn't talk about feelings. Mm. You know, you just got on with things. Mm. And so, and then I was raped when I was 13 and didn't tell anybody. So I think all of those factors I've remained very sensitive to the challenges of adolescence. But also, you know, sometimes people accuse me of writing dark things and, oh, you have to protect the children from the dark things. And I'm like, dude, they're living the dark things.
Exactly.
And what I just have such respect for teenagers, because you see they have that energy and yes, they're struggling and yes, they need us to listen and to be present for them. But they meet these challenges for the most part, you know, and there's such joy in overcoming challenges. It's like you don't grow unless you fall down first. Mm. And when they learn how to ask for support, when they learn how to make healthier choices, when they acknowledge, wow, that was kind of a big mistake, I'm going to do it differently next, that's such an important part of their development and growth, which is why there are parts of my book, I hope everybody can see those parts, that are actually kind of funny, because teenagers use humor as one of their weapons.
I was going to say that they are really funny also.
Yeah. I mean it's so bizarre. Adolescence, I mean, all of a sudden you have hair in places you didn't have hair before, and you smell different, and you have big, big feelings, and your mother's very confused and your father's just like walking out of the room all the time, and you have all of a sudden wonderful attractions to people, and you're like, oh my gosh, and you don't know, and it feels like you're the only person going through this, right? And this is where creating art for that age group is such a joy, and they get to see themselves in books, and maybe they can see other people, it'll help them understand, and I hope that they laugh.
I'm guessing that's a feeling that a lot of, at least your American readers, can relate to, like having a father who has been involved in the armed forces. That's really very common, I guess, in the US.
Yeah, I mean, I think we have been at war for almost 250 years.
Yeah.
There was a brief moment there when I got out of high school, and then boom, right back in it. Mm. It's an important part of the American economy. I hate to say it that way. My son is a captain in the U.S. Army, and something like 20% of our population is associated. Either there's a veteran in their family, there's somebody in the active armed forces. I have big feelings about this.
Yes.
because we, you know, we take these children, 18-year-olds, yes, are children. Our brains, again, are still growing. And the Army can be a wonderful opportunity, especially for kids coming from poverty. Because it allows them to get an education, because our education is so expensive. But the Army feels to me like a giant machine that eats people. And when they retire or they have to leave because their hearing is permanently damaged, we do not treat our veterans well. We don't help them. Mm. And I wrote a book, it's been translated into Swedish.
Yes.
You're going to have to pronounce it på svenska.
Sjärvor av minnen.
Sjärvor av minnen. that is precisely about the cost that the children of veterans pay for the neglect of their parents.
Yeah, I was thinking, like, because we talked about parents who are like unavailable. She is, I mean, the main character in Skärvor Aminen is really, I mean, she's
the parent.
She is the parent. She can't, I mean, she can't move away from home. She can't do anything.
Yeah.
It's really touching and sad, I think.
Yeah. I wrote that book because I'm from a, like I said, of a rural community in the north. And we went through this in my family because of my dad. My dad lost his job for many years and was very suicidal. And bless him, he was able to find a way through it. Mm. And but then in my community, when the last war started, the Gulf War, and then following that, all the other invasions and incursions the U.S. has done, and I saw in my community the kids just graduating high school, and so their parents were so proud, you know, because we were told this is, you know, we have to fight for freedom. It's colonialism again. But and then a few years later, the children come back from war and they're wounded or were going to funerals because they're dead. And I just saw the same cycle that those of us who are children of World War II vets, same cycle starting again and again. It's tragic.
What can you do? But what do you think can be done? I mean, except for
voting people out of office.
Exactly.
Not allowing criminals to run for president. Yeah. So many things one can do. Yeah.
Of course.
In the United States, we need to go back to teaching history. About 20 years ago, we had a new federal testing program called No Child Left Behind, which tied government funding for schools to how well the schools were doing, which is kind of backwards. But and, you know, we don't have, we're trying to develop national standards of education, but it's very much down to the states. And what so many schools across the country did to, in order to have time to prepare their students every year for these tests, they took time away permanently from teaching civics, government, and history. So now we've got, we're developing generations of Americans who don't understand our nation's history, which leads to a lot of political confrontations that are unnecessary because we don't have the same facts. And thus, when it comes to voting, that's when when it comes to having conversations about should we enter this war or what's our responsibility to our country and the other countries in the world, we're going on feelings. We're not going on information. And I think that's not good.
Yeah, I think that was what I was asking, actually. Of course, you can do lots of, but what can you do, like, for that?
Democracy does not exist unless you have an informed public.
That's so true.
That is true.
But I mean, if we can return to Haley, I just absolutely love her, but I perhaps feel even more infatuated with Finnegan.
Yeah.
But I just love as a character because he's funny and witty and so emotional and caring.
Yeah.
It felt, for me personally, I read first Winter Girls.
Yeah.
That was such a ordeal, I must say. I usually read pretty quickly, but that book took me 2 weeks, I think.
That's a horror novel.
Right, it really is. And then I read The Impossible Life of Memory.
Yeah.
And it felt like a spring rain, I guess you can feel reading about Finnegan because I just really like him.
That makes me so happy. I had to make him a little older because I sort of have a crush on him too. And we talked earlier about that period of alienation or that period of pulling away from the family of origin so you can develop fully as an adult. And he represents such a, you know, and also I want to make sure that you know, in Speak, the rapist is a really not a great person, and boys and men are awesome, and I wanted to have a male character that is just all the best.
Yeah,
he is, and he's silly, and he helps her, you know, the best kind of friend supports you even when, you know, when they disagree, but kind of help you. Maybe can help you more clearly see where you are as when you're struggling. And he does that. And I just adore him.
Yes.
Yeah. He's lovely.
I have to check on the questions.
Yeah. I was curious, what are some of your favorite authors or books?
That's a really tough question.
I know it's tough.
Yeah, right. It's like, wow. How long is this podcast? when we're talking about YA,
yes,
we've had the most amazing authors in the last 10, 15 years in the United States, kind of the, you know, I feel like I'm the auntie generation. And to see people like Angie Thomas and Jason Reynolds, just incredible young authors coming in with their own voices and their own stories and kind of doing a much filling out. We've had holes in our representation, and we need to see each other's stories. And there's been this giant debate in the U.S. Again, because we haven't learned the history of enslavement and how that's, you know, the echoes of slavery still affect every single American in one way or the other. And in children's literature, a friend of mine, Walter Dean Myers, who died sadly many years ago. He was kind of my uncle, you know, my literary uncle. He's a Black American, a veteran, who wrote incredible books. His book Monster was with my book Speak. They were both nominated for the National Book Award that year. And so we got to know each other pretty well. And he wrote an op-ed in the New York Times shortly before he died that just called out American children's literature for its lack of diversity. It's like there was room for one Black author in every year. And the industry responded too slowly, of course, always. It's institutions move slow. But this, that's another reason why the current backlash against children's authors and the book banning, it's so painful, because we were just beginning to bring in all these incredible people from every single American background, you know, and our shelves were beginning to fill up with wonderful stories. Lamar Giles, Meg Medina, who is our current ambassador of children's literature, whose family came from Cuba. And then I think in part of this banning backlash is because there are white people in America who just were uncomfortable. And because they kind of live in this bubble that is not real, but it felt real to them. And those books were threatening their self-definition. So my best list includes pretty much any book written in the last 15 years.
Yeah, cool. Yeah. Yeah, I was thinking about like the whole banning of books, of course, that you are very much
suffering from.
Exactly. And also like active in trying to stop.
Yeah.
Here in Sweden, we don't have, I mean, we do not have that kind of banning.
No.
We have sometimes tendencies that politicians want to meddle with, like drag queen story hours and stuff like that. Yeah. But I was just thinking, if, what do you think? I mean, it's a big difference between Sweden and the US, but if what can we do to deal with tendencies to censor or restrict like books for people?
I've learned recently that the way your school systems are set up are very different than ours. Because our school systems are run by local people who are voted by people within the school community.
Yes.
So they can, those, so the policies of a school district are very much driven by voters and can be manipulated. You guys don't have that. You have school districts that are run by professionals who are educated and well done. I think people in Sweden and Scandinavia in general trust the state. They trust the government much more than Americans do. But the tendencies, that's a really important thing. And I understand. Like there were the old-fashioned banning in the U.S. Because Speak has been, you know, banned or challenged since it came out 25 years ago.
Yeah.
And in the bad, good old days, a parent who had legitimate, they were worried about their kids. You know, you have to respect people who worry about their children. You can love them while you disagree with them. And they would go to their school and they would say, I don't think my kid can/should read this. And no child in America has ever been forced to read a book. So, you know, and you could have conversations with people like that. But what we're seeing now, and I think this is where it becomes applicable to Sweden, is the people who are banning books now are doing it because it's just part of their movement towards fascism. There's a group called Mothers for Liberty that should be called Mothers for Fascism. They're funded by dark money groups. These are and there's fine. I have no problems with Republicans. I have problems with fascists on the extreme wing of the Republican Party. Mm. I know that Svenska PEN had the first banned book week in Sweden last
year. Yeah, it was so fun to work with.
Overwhelmingly, I think Svenska PEN was so delighted. Some people I've talked to because there was such enthusiasm for it, and what that opens up. And this is finally I'm getting to the answer to your question. You have to have conversations about what democracy is.
Yes.
You have to have conversations in democracies about where do I end and where do you begin and how do we settle differences, right? And how do we decide what are the values for the collective us?
Mm. Exactly. Mm.
And and books are, you know, what's appropriate for children. That's a good conversation to have.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
I think so too.
Yeah.
But I mean, we touched a bit on it, or you touched a bit on it, your relationship with libraries. I listened to you last year at Litteralund.
Mm. Oh, gosh, that was a great conference.
Me too, I did.
Yes, you did.
Yeah, I was there.
It was like a truly magical moment. I just remembered crying.
Yeah.
It was just moving the way you talked about librarians and libraries, and usually we don't get elevated to those heights.
Yeah, well, I was still feeling very much 8 years old. And libraries were my sanctuary. You know, my family didn't have money to buy books. I think in the U.S., a lot of times when there's conversations like about censorship, the response is, well, they can just buy them on Amazon. Or even worse, they can get them from the library. And there are what we have in the U.S. called library deserts, where people don't live within driving distance if they have a car of a library. So to see a library, to be with librarians who have a very difficult job, especially those who work with teens, and you have to deal with bureaucracy. Just there's a lot of challenges. But we, especially librarians, those of us in the book community, anybody who was part of the Umeå Litfest, understand that in storytelling lies our salvation. Mm-hmm. In storytelling, which is I told you in that in Lund, it's in our bones. The need for story, the need to share story and to listen to stories. And so to me, you know, the library is my church. It's my holy place. And sharing stories to me is a sacred act of joy.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what it was really. That was a great room. That was a great room.
Yeah, it really was.
Ghoststemning.
Yeah, it was ghoststemning.
I think to a lot of people, it's a sanctuary and it's like a, it's a safe space. Hopefully,
yes, exactly.
And try to make it.
And you know, going back to in Sweden, the extreme push against, for example, LGBTQ people, and this is where we see the significance of story, and it becomes a safe space, but it also allows us to make sure that people who are being harmed, people who are being oppressed or marginalized, you can't just single out one person and make them the spokesperson. It's in a really responsible way. You can say, look at these books. You know, yes, these books need to be available. If you don't want to read about that, you don't have to. Isn't that great?
Exactly. Yeah.
But having choice and having vibrant, fun representation of everybody, that is a key to democracy.
Yeah.
That's so true.
Yeah, it's true.
I guess we can, let me check the questions. It's always like, you're always forgetting the important ones, I feel. yes, here we go. I just was curious, when you wrote Speak, the internet wasn't a big thing.
It didn't exist.
Yeah,
it didn't exist.
I was curious because we had an author in Sweden who wrote a very famous book years ago in the late 1990s about rape.
A Short Skirt?
Yeah. And then a few years later, she wrote a book called Villig, which was based on a true story, I guess you could say, about a girl who got raped and then got demolished on social media. Have you thought anything about your books in that view? Like what?
Yeah, you know, I try very much to resist the temptation to write a book about the new thing, because the new thing is old by the time the book comes out. But I do think that, and also, you know, my kids are grown now. So I think I have to be very mindful of about like what my next YA will be, because I don't have the access that I had. Now I'm watching my grandchildren grow up quickly. But when it comes to, for example, writing a book where manipulation on the internet is an important part of the story, I think I might take a step to the side and allow my younger colleagues to fill that role, because that's where they are. I think that it is almost immeasurably harder now to grow up in adolescence and become healthy and not get hurt. Because first of all, a lot of parents aren't aware of what's going on. We need to communicate better with families to help them be aware and to know how to deal with these things when they happen. It's almost like the internet is a lawless place, and kids do dangerous, dumb things. Everybody makes mistakes, but the mistakes you can make online can like end another person's life. So the stakes are very, very high. So I think about it all the time. Because I hear so many stories, but I don't think I'm the right person to write those stories. I'll make sure that I'm like making sure when they come out, I can help promote them.
I also have a question. If someone like a young person who has suffered abuse or other like traumatic experiences and would like to write about them, like you have, what is your advice for them?
Do it. Don't put it online. Which is hard, because I think often an important part of writing is that you want to share that with somebody. And I would encourage a young person, like if they have trusted friends or relatives that they want to share their story with, print it out. But once you put something online, first of all, it's so, even as a professional author, I've been so fortunate, and like people have said nice things and I've made a career out of this, I would never put like a draft online, because you're just opening yourself up for people to shove knives in your back, and your heart is in that story, right? So find a way to share it in a more traditional way, hand to hand, face to face, and don't give the trolls anything to eat.
I'm guessing writing in the way that you do, like putting some parts of your life into the books. Can you see some of the, you can see the benefits of just bringing it to the table. And do you see any risks about writing that way?
I think you have to be in a healthy place to do it. I never had an eating disorder, for example, but I did have some unhealthy habits of over-exercise and tying my self-worth too closely to how much I weighed. Just kind of a little bit on the edge. So when I decided to work on Winter Girls, I talked to a lot of experts, and I made my writing of that book happen in shorter blocks. And I would end the book, I would end writing earlier in the day and get outside and like really focus on healthy coping mechanisms so that I wouldn't get caught up in the spiral. So I think that, you know, a lot of us write stories, those of us who write for teenagers, we write kind of, like I'm thinking of David Levithan.
Yes.
You know, those authors who you just get sucked into the story. And I think when you feel deeply connected to a book, what you're seeing is not necessarily the author's actual experience. It's not necessarily biographical, but you're seeing some of the author's emotional truth, a truth that's kind of on a larger scale. And in truth, just use that word twice in a sentence. Got to go back and revise that now. The brain, it never stops. I think we need to lift up the positive aspects of writing. When you're writing about your emotional truth, when you can disguise it and fix it, fiction or not, that's actually quite healthy. And I think that's, you know, the smart teachers use all the arts, you know, music and dance and visual arts as a way to help teenagers express emotions that they might not even have the name for yet. So that works out well for everybody. It's good, good stuff.
Do you have like a method for your writing days? I just don't know that.
Since the censorship kicked off really hard in the U.S. in 2021, it's been kind of a hot mess.
Yes.
But I, generally speaking, when I'm at home, I like to get up early. I like, you know, to be up by five, several cups of coffee. And I, you know, don't, I never look at email if anybody's ever tried to get a hold of me. But then I have a small room in the house that's got a very comfy chair. And that's, that room is the safe space. That's like, it's my hygge spot. And I will try to, on a good day, I will probably write from 6 until like 3, 4 o'clock. And with breaks for more beverages, and then I have to go to the bathroom. And then I go for a walk, go to the gym. And then the rest of the time is ignoring email and hanging out with my family. And I have to say, in the last year, I've started to play Animal Crossing with my grandson. So that's now an important part of the writing process.
Of course. It sounds nice.
Yeah.
But do you write by hand or on the computer?
You know, I do a lot of journaling. I always have a journal with me, which is just filled with my the junk in my brain. But some, like, I often think about a book for several years before I start writing it, because I have to go out, like, I'm like a beachcomber, you know, somebody goes to the beach and takes what the tides have brought in, and I collect all these little ideas and characters and problems. I'm looking for what's making somebody's life hard. I'm looking for the right problem, and then how does that affect this character? And then slowly my collection begins to accumulate, and then at some point I can hear the voice of the character. It's a little bit like my voice, but it's very distinct. And that's when I sit down on a laptop and start writing.
That's so cool.
Yeah. And it's interesting. Can I just go off for one moment here?
Yes, because please. That's
so my that's how I write YAs. That's really starts. It's very character driven, with just kind of the kernel of a plot, like that piece of sand that gets into an oyster and becomes the pearl. My historical fiction, which is the other half of my career, writing about American history, starts with a plot. And it starts with actual events that happened in a certain time in a certain place that had an effect on American history. So I have to do all this research for years and learn that world, and then figure out how were those historical events affecting an ordinary kid, not George Washington, just an ordinary child, whether that's a child who's held in slavery, which is some of my books, or not, but working class people, if they're not enslaved people. And then, so the plot comes first, and then the character development, and then interacting, kind of braiding, weaving together the plot and the plot of the historical events and the plot of the character's life. So, and it's completely different than YA, and I have a short attention span, so it's nice to go between the two types of books.
Yeah. Yeah, I heard you have a new historical novel coming out.
Yeah, and I was, you never tell anybody that you're never going to do something again, because you're always going to wind up doing it. I'm returned to the American Revolution. I got COVID very early in the pandemic in late March of 2020. Oh, mercy, I was sick. Woohoo. Thankfully, get through it. Got vaccinated as soon as I could. But when I was so sick recovering from that first bout of COVID, I remembered that Abigail Adams, who's an important president, was married to her. She should be the head figure there. I remembered that she and her family had a vaccine. There was good documentation of when they got inoculated. Inoculation was an early form of vaccination. When they were inoculated against smallpox. And then I discovered that in Boston, at the beginning of the war, smallpox was very threatening. And I just saw the historical echoes and all the confusion and the fear and the misinformation in a time of great political uproar that we experienced in the U.S. in 2020, which continues now. And then you layer on top of it a medical crisis. It was exactly what happened in the summer of 1776. So I had to write the book. It's called Rebellion, 1776. Comes out in October.
Yeah.
So cool.
Oh, yeah. And the cover artist is Swedish.
Really?
Yeah, I had nothing to do with that, I have to say. But yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, so I'll be sure that I put her name on all of my social media posts, because she's a wonderful artist.
Perfect. Yeah. Nice.
Are you starting to maybe writing a new YA book?
Yeah, I've got a lot of ideas. And I'm collecting my shells and stones and twigs on the beach of my mind. Mm-hmm. But I don't have it yet.
It'll come.
It'll come. Sure. It'll
We're
come.
Looking forward to it.
Yeah. Too.
Yeah.
I will be probably in another month or so. Over the summer, I'll be adapting. I have a novel that I wrote about a teenage boy called Twisted.
Yeah.
Mm. That hasn't been translated in any Scandinavian language yet. Yeah. I hope it does be.
Yeah.
But I'm adapting that for a graphic novel.
Oh.
Cool.
And it's going to be interesting.
Yeah, and it has an element of video games in it, which was my excuse for having to learn how to play Animal Crossing and Zelda.
Great choices.
Yeah. I'm not very good at Zelda, I have to say. I get deaded a lot.
It's a very difficult game.
Yeah.
It's a long game.
Yeah, which I like. I really love the different worlds. Mm. It's a fantastic... I really kind of have been, whenever I play it, it's storytelling. Mm. I think that's what unites all these arts that connect kids. That you hear sometimes adults get all, oh, the children today, look at their rep, whatever the new thing that adults are disrespecting. But almost always it's just a different form of engaging in story.
Yeah.
Mm. Which is super fun. Yeah. And healthy.
I think that's...
That was it, I think.
Yes,
yeah, it's been so lovely to have you here in Umeå as well.
Umeå is the best. Oh, my gosh. I just have to thank everybody in Sweden. Tack så mycket. Because my experience in Sweden in the past year has been extraordinary. And I've just been so welcomed, and it's been such a breath of fresh air to step off the plane and know that this is a country, and all countries are facing their own issues, but this is a culture that supports books, a culture that supports children, and it's a joy to, and you've got great cinnamon buns. So that's it all ties together. Tack så mycket.
Thank you so much for coming here and for being on Ungpodden with us.
Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Det var et fornøyelse.
Yep.